It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out this week. Coming up on Central Time, we'll wrap up our look at the top science and technology news from 2015 with Discover Magazine editors. Today we'll talk to Gemma Tarlak about stories ranging from the latest in hologram technology, the earliest known dental procedure performed with stone tools. First, a major storm that has affected areas from New Mexico to Wisconsin continues to march across the country today. The system has caused deaths in Texas and Missouri, mainly because of tornadoes and flash flooding. The governor of New Mexico declared a state of emergency there. Here in much of Wisconsin, we're seeing a lot of snow and a wintry mix for one of the first times this season. Joining us now is Sean Lux, meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in Green Bay. Sean, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. It's great to talk with you today.
Well, southern Wisconsin spending much of the day today and into tomorrow under this winter storm warning. What kind of conditions are we seeing around the state right now?
This afternoon, been looking at snow accumulating rapidly in the southern part of the state. It seemed like every time I looked, it was going from, 1 to 2 inches to 2 to 3 to 2 to 4. And last time I looked, it was maybe 10 minutes ago. So I wouldn't be surprised if there were places with more than 4 inches now. Now into the next little bit, starting to see reports of that snow changing over to sleet down in southern Wisconsin, while snow starts to push in and begin in the northern half of the state.
And how much of that sleet or freezing rain are we expected to see overnight here?
A swath of snow that's, maybe 8 to 12 inches from the southwest to the northeast corner of the state, and then that tails off as you go towards the northwest and southeast. But I guess the southeast doesn't really get off that easy. Starting to look at with a little bit of warmer air a few thousand feet up at, getting some change to sleet and maybe even some freezing rain with accumulations of, maybe a tenth to a quarter of an inch.
Well, there are a lot of weird things about this storm system. The fact we're getting snow and freezing rain in December isn't so weird. But one strange thing is you're in Green Bay. This is really your first significant snowfall, as I understand it there?
Yeah. Up until just a few minutes ago when the snow started, we'd only seen a half an inch of snow total up until this snow is beginning. And that's been in several clumps. So we haven't had a full inch of snow for snow depth yet, which is one of the longest on record for how deep we go into December without getting that first snow.
And this has been, I think, where I'm sitting, an unusually mild winter so far. Are we talking about El Nino for the cause of that?
A lot of times in this area, when you see an El Nino, particularly a strong one like the one we've had this year, you do tend to see temperatures a little more mild in the winter months in Wisconsin.
Talking to Sean Lux from the National Weather Service's Green Bay office about this storm sweeping the nation. We're getting some fairly seasonal Wisconsin-type weather, snow, sleet, freezing rain. Be careful driving out there. But, Sean, this has been dangerous, far more dangerous around the rest of the country. The weird thing, the surprising thing to me anyway, is a lot of tornadoes in December. One reported in Michigan last week in Canton, Michigan. I was near there for the holidays. And, of course, all these deadly ones in Texas. How unusual is it to see tornadoes like this happening in December?
It would be something that maybe isn't particularly common, but it's not totally unheard of either. The spot you'd look to see possible tornadoes in the winter months would be kind of towards the south and southeast from Texas. Eastward, a tornado in Michigan in December is pretty closer to the rare scale on that thing goes. But a lot of times when you do get these really powerful storms like this, you will get kind of that warm side where you do see severe weather.
Now, looking at this storm on a national weather map, this is a big storm. And we're talking Texas up here to Wisconsin and that wide as it heads west to east. Can you talk about some of the conditions behind a storm that size?
I've seen quite a few kind of notable things going on with this storm. I remember this weekend that people were watching the Sun Bowl in El Paso down in far west Texas, and it was not particularly well named this year, as they were having snow at the Sun Bowl. Then I've also seen things like drifts of snow over 10 feet high in West Texas and the Texas Panhandle. As your news had mentioned earlier, serious ice accumulations in Oklahoma, and then flooding rains from Texas right up to Illinois, and then the severe weather you mentioned as well with the tornadoes.
Yeah, and what kind of conditions make this kind of unusual activity happen in places like Texas and Oklahoma?
Kind of look for, just kind of a powerful storm kind of moving in, and then starts to develop over that desert southwest area and move up. And in that situation, it can kind of tap into the colder air brought in from the north to help create those serious winter weather conditions on the cold side of the storm. But then you can also tap into warmth and moisture from the Gulf of Mexico, which will kind of help amp the storm up and provide the potential for the severe weather and flooding on the warm side of the storm.
Moving back to Wisconsin, we've been hearing in the news likely strong winds through the night. How long are we going to be watching for unpleasant conditions here in the state?
We'll really be looking for things to peak really this evening and tonight. Of course, particularly concerned about, people traveling home from work on their evening commute. It's particularly poor timing to have a strong storm moving through, possibly generating, even near whiteout conditions in spots. Then also look for kind of peak impact into tonight, and then hopefully start to see things tail off towards tomorrow morning.
Looking ahead, this is one of our bigger storms so far this winter. Any other winter weather on the horizon, or are we going to see a return to spring or summer-like conditions that we've had so far?
That can get somewhat tough when you start to look farther out. There are indications looking ahead that we might start to see the start of a pattern change that might bring us back to something a little more typical of a Wisconsin winter. I don't think we'll see the torch that carried us through December necessarily continue. But I think we'll probably remember this December for a long time. It's been quite a warm start to the season.
Well, Sean, I bet you want to get your eye back on the radar, so thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, yeah. Thanks for letting me talk to you. I appreciate it.
That was meteorologist Sean Looks from the National Weather Service Green Bay office talking about today's winter storm that's affecting states from New Mexico and Texas to Michigan and here in Wisconsin. Every Monday in December, we're looking at the top science news from 2015. So far, we've talked about astronomy, anthropology, and archaeology, some physics in there. Now it's time for some fun stuff. We're taking a look at the top pop science stories with Gemma Tarlak. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, happy new year to you and everyone listening.
And happy almost new year to you as well. Well, I want to take us back to earlier in 2015, this viral thing all over social media. The dress. Remind us what the dress was.
Oh my gosh. Can I just tell you, we all kind of assumed those 15 minutes of fame for this photo were over, but no, science has gotten hold of it. You may remember, if you're like me, your Facebook feed blew up last spring when everyone started talking about this dress. People just arguing about this blue and a black dress, and then people would say just as passionately, no, what's wrong with you? It's white and gold.
Right. These are not subtle gradations of color. People think
exactly.
It's blue and black or white and gold.
Right, and it wasn't like a colorblind thing. It wasn't, any kind of bias that it seemed obvious, but people just felt so passionately about what they were seeing. And it went crazy. I mean, it really broke the internet, as they say. So finally, we thought, then it died down and it went away and it was just a thing, but then science got hold of it. And color analysts, people who research how color vision works in our species, realize this is the first time ever we have a documented incident of people perceiving something so differently. And so they really started researching it, and their preliminary results, which were published in June, are fascinating.
So this viral thing, goofy thing, actually tells us something important about the way our brains and I guess our eyes perceive color. What are scientists saying we're learning from this?
Yeah, well, they're just theories right now. But one of the things they noticed the majority of people do see the dress as blue and black, which it actually is.
Right, you see it on a model, like against a human skin tone.
Right.
It's clearly blue and black.
Right, and about a third of the population sees the dress consistently as white and gold, which is, you know, a very different thing. And when I say see the dress as, I'm talking about the original photo. Mm-hmm. And that's the key. It's not the dress itself. It's the original photo, which was taken with a smartphone of a window display through the window. Now, that actual photo, the dress has a completely ambiguous lighting situation. And that's really key to the science behind this, because the dress was exposed in the photo to natural light. It was in a window display, you know, but it was also lit by artificial light from the store itself. And that is really the key, because we all have a different bias based on the kind of light we are used to being exposed to. So, for example, one theory is that early risers, people who tend to get a lot of natural light, they saw the dress as white and gold because their bias is to correct for color in a natural light setting. But night owls actually tended to see the dress as blue and black, and that's because they're usually exposed to artificial light more so than, you know, early risers. So they actually corrected, you know, their brains corrected for artificial lighting. So it's really fascinating. There's some disagreement about exactly why people perceive it differently, but most researchers agree it has to do with your natural bias. Now, exactly how that bias formed, that's what's really open to debate. But it's just a fascinating and fun thing to talk about, quite frankly.
Fascinating and fun and a little unsettling, because I assume that red is red. And for those who use words like chartreuse and magenta, they are always going to mean the same thing. What we're learning here is that, at least in some situations, our brains are filtering and processing and color correcting in ways that may make us disagree with each other about what a color is.
Exactly. Isn't that crazy?
Well, I want to move to another visual phenomenon now with a tactile. It's going to reach to two senses. This year, a new kind of hologram was created. So hologram, these 3D light images. We saw one of Tupac at a award ceremony some years back. They're big in Star Wars movies. But now there's one that we might be able to feel and interact with. So talk us through this, Gemma.
Yeah, well, this young Japanese researcher showed off what's the first airborne hologram. Now, that means it's not, you know, against the screen or whatever. It's there in 3D. And you can actually touch it. You can feel it when you touch it. And by touching it, you can manipulate it. The way he figured out how to do this actually sounds kind of scary, but he found a way to precisely focus infrared laser light and to have it pulse at a ridiculously fast speed. Because if this particular laser is pulsing at nanoseconds, which, you know, is like a hundredth of a second, it'll burn your finger. Mm-hmm. But he figured out if he got it to pulse in femtoseconds, those are quadrillionths of a second, so we're talking teeny, 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 tiny seconds, it actually, you can feel it without it really hurting or damaging your finger. And you can, you know, like, it stir it up and make it move and stuff, and it feels, he says, like sandpaper. So it's a little bit of a tingling sensation, and I have to say that tingling sensation is actually coming from the laser ionizing your skin surface and turning it into plasma, which is kind of scary.
Uh-huh.
But it's not going to damage your skin because it's so short and quick.
So I'm not thinking I'm going to run out and buy this as a kid's toy, Gemma, right off the bat. If, you know, because I wouldn't perceive the difference between leaving it on for a quadrillionth of a second and a nanosecond. Is it a billionth?
Yeah, well, that's how fast the laser pulses.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can think of it, if you've ever grabbed something or touched a hot pot on the stove, if you touch it for just the briefest second to appreciate that, hey, I shouldn't touch this, it's hot, it's not really going to burn you. But if you really grab it and hold it for longer, it's going to burn you. It's kind of the same principle. But he's gotten it to pulse much faster so that it's safer. He says, and he's thinking about, you know, side of maybe having, I don't know, Tupac in your living room in a way that, I don't know, maybe you could, you know, reach out and touch him. He's still working out the details, this researcher, but he's thinking big. He's thinking this could be like a stadium event size thing at some point in his lifetime.
Right. This is a 28-year-old scientist.
Yeah.
He's envisioning a new mode of entertainment that we might have used, might have thought as a science fiction thing, holodeck from Star Trek or something like that.
Exactly. And he's also talking about maybe for roads and for runways, creating different kinds of markers that would be a little easier to see, especially in weather like we've got today in Wisconsin. And so he's all these applications for it. Right now, he's just got this little tiny little kind of globe that you can poke with your finger, and it's really minute. It's, you know, kind of pinhead size. But he's taking it big. So we'll see where he goes in the next few years with this.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. We're continuing our December roundup of the top news stories from the worlds of science and technology. Well, here's a big one for dinosaur fans, Gemma. The Brontosaurus is back. So first tell us why it went away.
Well, okay, we all know and love Brontosaurus, but for a long time there was this argument that Brontosaurus was not an actual species, that it was cobbled together kind of at the end of the 19th century when there was this huge, huge push to find fossils, especially in the American West and in places like China. There was this huge push to find fossils, not as big a push to study them really rigorously. So a lot of species kind of got named and then unnamed. Brontosaurus was one of them. And paleontologists from about 1903 on said, yeah, it's not a real species. It's just a piece of an apatosaurus from here, piece of another sauropod from there. So I think because Brontosaurus has such a cute, friendly image, we kind of held him dear in our hearts, even though he was disgraced. This young paleontologist decided, well, I'm going to analyze the entire family that Brontosaurus belongs to, and I'm going to do it by looking at every single fragmentary fossil ever found, and then using this very sophisticated statistical analysis to look at them in a way they've never been looked at before. He didn't set out to bring Brontosaurus back, by the way. He was just really trying to analyze this family of the long-necked, long-tailed dinosaurs that we call sauropods. And so he did this, and as he was doing it, he realized that all these very clear differences were emerging between the Brontosaurus fossils, the previously called Brontosaurus fossils, and other fossils like Apatosaurus. And just based on the statistical analysis and the number of variables he found between the fossils, he said, yeah, Brontosaurus is actually a legitimate species. So it's yay, it's real again.
Well, yay for that. And actually one of the things I liked most about that story, you had a quote, I think it was from that researcher or somebody involved in it, saying part of the story here isn't just about the Brontosaurus, but about how we should think of science, that we shouldn't think this bit of science is done and we could put that on the shelf and now we're going to move on to the next bit, but rather science is this ongoing conversation where we have to keep revisiting the things we know or think we know.
Yeah, and what I find really fascinating about this researcher he is actually testing his results right now, and he's using live lizards. He's going to do the same statistical analysis on a live lizard family and then use DNA to kind of check himself. And that's, he's just really kind of trying to punch holes in his own theory. And that's how science works when it's at its best. So it's really fascinating stuff.
Well, I want to wrap up on one of your favorite stories. Researchers have found the oldest known dental procedures in humans. What do we got?
Yes, I have to say it's one of my favorite stories because I love horrifying people. I really do. But it's one of my favorites because every time I explain the story to my colleagues here at Discover, the reaction I got was basically a shriek of horror. And I also want to say I really feel for this guy, for this 14,000-year-old guy. We know it's a guy that they found his skeleton in a cave in northern Italy. And they realized that one of his teeth had all these marks on it. So they did some very sophisticated analysis, including using modern teeth that had been extracted. They tried to replicate the marks on modern teeth. They realized he took a sharp stone tool, he or maybe one of his buddies, and was basically hacking away at an infection in his tooth. This poor guy, this is the first and earliest evidence of dentistry that we have. Previously, we had about a 9,000-year-old record that someone was meddling with a tooth trying to get the, you know, infection out, but this is 14,000 years old. And if you just picture the poor guy, you know, trying to get rid of this infection, your heart goes out to him. But yeah, he was partially successful, I can say, and he survived. He lived beyond the infection, so, you know, he's got that going for him. But if you dread going to the dentist, just think, be glad, they're not using stone tools anymore.
Well, it's an amazing story. I mean, 14,000 years ago, probably some nomadic hunter-gatherer group, trial and error, or for all we know, this is one we found, maybe they had an established system of dental procedures. Like, oh, you got that cavity, you're going in there with the stone scraper. Maybe this wasn't the only guy who did this.
Yeah, you know, it could well be. It could well be. Every year we find out fascinating things, and we really change the timelines that we thought we knew. But for right now, you know, my heart goes out to this poor guy 14,000 years ago, and I just love the reaction I get from people when I tell them.
Well, a visit to the dentist, you're right, Gemma, doesn't sound so bad now. Thanks, as always, and we're looking forward to talking to you in 2016.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
That's Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She was with us to talk about the coolest pop science stories of 2015, and she joined us pretty much every month here on Central Time for a look at the latest in the worlds of science and technology. The science of happiness is a hot field today, but it wasn't always like that. For a long time, researchers were preoccupied with finding out what's wrong with us, not what makes us thrive. And that's where Richard Davidson came in. His work studying the effects of mindfulness using the tools of neuroscience have made him one of the foremost experts in the world on the brain and well-being. Davidson's work collaborating with the Dalai Lama and studying the brains of Buddhist monks, expert meditators, helped him earn the title of one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. Today, he's the director of the Wiseman Laboratory for Brain Imaging and Behavior and founder of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. Veronica Rickert and I talked to Richard Davidson at an event earlier this year in Madison.
We're going to start with a basic question. What is mindfulness?
Well, mindfulness has been defined in many different ways. And if you talk to a scholar from the contemplative traditions from which it's derived, they may have a very different sense of it than the sense that is often displayed in popular media and by modern psychologists. The way modern psychologists typically define mindfulness is paying attention on purpose, non-judgmentally. That's a standard way in which it's defined. I was just very recently at a lunch a couple of weeks ago in New York City in honor of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday. And His Holiness was there. And I came back and I said to one of my friends, I learned something about mindfulness and what it is from being with His Holiness. And what I came back and said is that mindfulness, as exemplified in the demeanor of the Dalai Lama, is treating every single human being like they have the full potential to be a realized Buddha, to be a kind and compassionate being, to exemplify the most positive, extraordinary qualities that are available to us as human beings, treating every single human being that way every single moment of the time, and remembering that that is really at the core of our being. And that's what mindfulness is. It's bringing that awareness moment to moment, at every moment, and addressing each individual in that kind of way. So it's a different way of framing mindfulness.
And you took it in a new direction in a lot of ways, trying to see what mindfulness looked like in the brain. We hear a lot about neuroscience and investigating emotions and where they come from nowadays. But when you started out with this, what kind of reaction did you get telling people you wanted to research where the emotions were housed in our brains?
Well, I was treated quite skeptically at the very beginning. Emotions have had a checkered history in the biobehavioral sciences. There was a time when neuroscientists believed that most emotion occurred in subcortical structures. These are structures that sit below the highest centers of our brain and kind of have to do with the most base human qualities. And it then became apparent that this simple-minded view that largely derived from research at the rodent level, mostly with rats and mice, that this wasn't a particularly useful framework for thinking about human emotion, and that human emotion involved much more, and that when we think about human emotion and we think about life's major decisions, think about who you have chosen to be your spouse. Think about very significant purchases like a house that you may have purchased. Those are not decisions that can be easily made without emotion. Emotions inform those decisions in a very useful way, and individuals who have difficulty identifying their emotions and difficulty discerning their emotions actually have problems making those kinds of decisions. And so we then began to search for emotions in other parts of the brain that involve the highest centers of the brain, and sure enough, there is extensive representation of emotion that we find there.
And to reference the Dalai Lama's quote that began us all off, he asked you, well, you're looking at anxiety, you're looking at fear, why not apply these tools of neuroscience to positive emotions? You did that. You went and you managed to work with some expert meditators, in this case Buddhist monks, who had clocked, what was it, hundreds of hours of meditation?
Thousands? Tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands, yeah, in their lifetimes. And you worked with them and you looked at their brain through neuroimaging for the first time, looking at these qualities of mindfulness, of well-being. What did you find?
Well, these were really important initial studies because we reasoned that if we did not find anything that was a clear signal in the brains of these so-called expert meditators, we were unlikely going to find signals in the brains of more novice practitioners. And so this was a very reasonable place to start. And we had the great fortune of having an amazing recruiter who can recruit these participants for us, and that was none other than the Dalai Lama himself. What we did in those early years is we flew people who resided in Asia, typically in India and Nepal, and they came to Madison and spent some period of time in residence in our laboratory, and then we poked and probed them in different ways to learn about what may be different about their brains. And the amazing thing was that very soon into this project, we began to see signals that have never before been seen in a human brain, signals that were very unusual and that clearly indicated that there was something different about these brains. And this was really the beginning of this journey. We were not able to definitively conclude that these signals were produced by meditation because these are individuals who are highly rarefied people. The average number of lifetime hours of practice among these individuals was about 34,000 hours of practice. And so you can go do the arithmetic at home, but 34,000 hours is a huge number. Most people would not make the choice to spend that kind of time doing this sort of thing. And so the skeptics said to us, well, maybe their brains were just different to begin with. While the findings from these practitioners were necessary, they were clearly not sufficient in helping us to discover what may be important in going on, that's going on in the brains of these individuals.
Well, you're hinting at this. Many of us will not meditate for 34,000 hours in our lifetimes. I know you've looked at shorter spans of time. Can short bursts, I don't think burst is a good word for meditation, but short spells of meditation make a noticeable difference in our brains? Can we see, start to see a bit of that same kind of signal?
It's such an American question. But after
can
all,
we do it
we
fast,
are.
Man?
Right. And the answer is yes. We can see changes in the brain after really short periods of practice, which is quite amazing. We published a study a couple of years ago in complete novices, and we had them go through 2 weeks of training where they were practicing about 30 minutes a day, so it was a total of 7 hours. And we did brain scans, MRI scans, on these participants before and after this two-week period of practice. And sure enough, we were able to see changes after just this short period of time. So it is the case that really short periods of time can make a difference. And I would say that even less than a half an hour is perfectly acceptable and can produce real change. And when individuals come to me and say, well, they just can't meditate and doing 30 minutes is impossible, start with 2 minutes, really short periods. And then one can gradually build up. And it's sort of like physical exercise. You wouldn't jump into doing a major marathon if you are completely out of shape, but you can start slowly and begin to see if this is something that is producing benefit.
Richard Davidson is a UW-Madison neuroscientist who studies the effects of mindfulness on the brain. Earlier this year, Veronica Rickert and I talked to Richard Davidson, one of the world's leading authorities on the brain and mindfulness. We pick up now with the question, are people basically good?
One of the things I know you're looking at now that's been a little bit more controversial, but there is some evidence starting to pile up, is that maybe people are innately good. And by that I mean maybe they lean a little toward altruism. If they have a choice between the two, they're going to pick the positive. What do you know about where we are on that?
Yeah, it's a great question, Veronica, and I love to talk about this. And it's a burgeoning area of scientific interest. You're quite right that it is more controversial than some of the other topics, largely because the evidence is not yet as robust as we would like. But there's increasing evidence to suggest that if an individual is given a choice between an altruistic and a warm-hearted encounter compared to one that is selfish, competitive, aggressive, the individual will consistently choose the warm-hearted, altruistic encounter. And these biases that I call innate basic goodness can be discerned very early in life. And I can give you an example of that. But, you know, it's when we think about it, people don't sign up for courses to learn how to become more angry or more sad. They do sign up for things where they can learn how to become more happy and improve their well-being. And so there is some kind of face valid evidence that there isn't a natural predisposition for people to increase their negative emotions. The evidence in young infants is particularly interesting. If we show a very young infant, say 6 months of age, a short video clip depicting a warm-hearted, altruistic encounter compared to one that is selfish, the six-month-old infant will consistently prefer the warm-hearted, altruistic encounter. Now, how do we know a six-month-old infant would prefer it? You ask them. And the way we ask a six-month-old infant is one way we could do it is by monitoring very carefully with infrared eye tracking. We can monitor their eye movements. And so we can look to see where they're looking. And they prefer to look at the warm-hearted, altruistic encounter compared to one that is very, very carefully matched on all other characteristics but depicts a selfish and aggressive encounter.
Staying with positive behavior, I know you've been talking about generosity lately as a positive behavior that brings us benefits and maybe reinforces more positive behavior in the future.
Yeah, so generosity is really an interesting one. We've recently written this piece that's part of the UN World Happiness Report that came out in April of 2015. And this is the first year, this is the third year that this report has come out. It's the first year that there's a section on neuroscience in that report, and we wrote that section on the neuroscience of well-being, and we talk about four different constituents of well-being that have been neuroscientifically investigated and validated. And one of those, interestingly, is generosity. The act of generosity activates circuits in the brain very, very powerfully that are associated with positive emotion. Giving, you know, the Dalai Lama has been saying this for years. The most effective strategy for promoting happiness is to be generous to others. And the data, the neuroscientific data, are consistent with that. And there are also psychological data that are consistent with that. There are these crazy studies that social psychologists have done where people come into the lab in the morning and they're given $100 in cash and they're told, go spend this money on whatever you'd like that you have felt guilty about buying for yourself. Here's $100. The only constraint is you must spend every penny on yourselves. Another group that's randomly assigned is given the same $100 and told to spend that money for gifts for others. And they come back in the lab at the end of the day. Guess which group shows a very significant boost in happiness? Of course, it's the group who is purchasing gifts for others. And so there's a lot of evidence to suggest that generosity really does promote well-being.
That's so interesting, because you think you spend so much time trying to hang on to your acquisitions and protect things even for your family, but are you saying we might actually be putting a ding in our own happiness by doing that, that if we would just focus on giving away, we could have measurable increase in well-being and happiness?
Yeah, this is the premise, Veronica, of Dan Gilbert's book, Stumbling on Happiness. Dan Gilbert is a psychologist at Harvard, a colleague and a good friend, and wrote this book called Stumbling on Happiness. And that's exactly the premise, that we misconstrue the causes of our own happiness. And the empirical work does clearly suggest that beyond a certain minimal level of material possessions, that anything beyond that really does not contribute in any significant way to our happiness.
Didn't they used to put a price tag on it, though, and money can buy happiness, say, up to $50,000 or something like that? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that there are important elements of truth in that. And so beyond some minimal basic level of support, the data, from my perspective, really does not suggest that increased income beyond that is linearly associated with happiness.
Another area I think you've been looking at is epigenetics, they call it. So we've got our genes, and we used to kind of think of it as a blueprint. The genes lead directly to this. It's way more complicated than that. Some genes get activated, some don't. What are you looking at in that area?
Yeah, so that's a great question. What's happening in genomics is kind of parallel to what's happened with neuroplasticity and neuroscience. There's much more dynamic change in these systems than we previously thought was possible. You can think of genes having little volume controls, many genes, and these volume controls regulate the extent to which a gene is turned on or turned off. And it turns out that our emotions, our demeanor, the qualities of our well-being impact that. And there are specific practices that impact that, specific training. And we published a paper last year showing that one intensive day of meditation, 8 hours among experienced meditators, was sufficient to produce a measurable change in their gene expression. And we had control participants come into the laboratory for a day of leisure. And we saw no change in those individuals who had the same sedentary day. So it appears that the regulation of our genes is under much more dynamic control. And this really has profoundly important impact for our health, because a lot of these genes are affected by practices that can promote well-being are genes involved in, for example, inflammation. And we know that inflammation is at the core of many chronic illnesses.
And I know another area of interest to you particularly is your work with children. So you're looking at how some of these mindfulness practices, cultivating kindness, things like that, can have an impact on the young developing brain. Can you tell us a little bit about where your research is leading you there?
Yeah, so this is really an extension of our work. We call it translational research, where we take the insights that we have gleaned from basic research in the laboratory and bring it out to real-world contexts. And we reason that if we can help young children to promote positive qualities of mind and provide them with simple exercises and skills that can then become lifelong, we could potentially, with modest interventions early on, have multiplicative effects as the children develop. When we first began to think about this, we went to the Dalai Lama and I asked him for advice about what kinds of practices would be most appropriate for young children, and he just looked at me and started laughing hysterically and said, "I've never had children, so I have no idea." So he said, "Please use science to investigate this." So that's what we've been doing, and we've developed a curriculum that we call the Kindness Curriculum, which is a curriculum that right now is focused for preschool children. We have been implementing this in the Madison Metropolitan School District in randomized controlled trials, and the first scientific paper based on this curriculum just came out this year, just a couple of months ago, showing really positive benefit from a 12-week curriculum that teaches children simple practices of mindfulness and kindness.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Richard Davidson, director of the Wiseman Laboratory for Brain Imaging and Behavior and founder of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. We talked to him earlier this year. The Harlem Globetrotters come to Wisconsin this week, scheduled to perform tonight in Madison, weather permitting, and their annual New Year's Eve show in Milwaukee. While they're entertaining fans with their mix of basketball, comedy, and performance art, they'll also be celebrating the life and mourning the passing of legendary Globetrotter Meadowlark Lemon, the clown prince of basketball, who passed away yesterday at the age of 83. Lemon was born Meadow George Lemon III. He played for the Globetrotters for 24 years. He was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame in 2003. ESPN quotes him as saying, when he was inducted, "My destiny was to make people happy." He's a guy, he definitely made me happy, probably my favorite member of the team. I saw him play as a kid while he was still on the team. I remember the bucket confetti, bucket of water trick. I wasn't close enough in the stands to get confetti or water on me, actually. I remember, of course, watching the Harlem Globetrotters cartoon show, Harlem Globetrotters on Return to Gilligan's Island, and of course on Scooby-Doo. They had a guest appearance when they had celebrity cameos there. Meadowlark Lemon, always a focus of all of those shows. And we saw the Harlem Globetrotters in Madison a year or two ago, of course, and a lot of great spirit there, a lot of great history with that team. So a farewell to the great Globetrotter, Meadowlark Lemon. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.